You're making big profits from my work, my risk, my sweat. But that is okay. Because I elected it to make that deal. But now, the deal is over. I want my end, and I am out. My money in 24 hours, or you will wear your ass for a hat.
Okay, how about it?
Junk food supper.
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 Welcome to Junk Food Supper, the pretty regular but not exactly weekly podcast where a couple of guys get together and we talk about all kinds of crazy ass movies and other things like that. And we also praise the Lord Jesus Christ for saving Gonzo's life and only giving him a bee sting. I'm Parker, and I'm joined, as always, by Sean Byron. How are you, Sean Byron?
I am feeling relieved, for one, that the Gonzo seems like he's going to make it. I mean, I don't have the verdict on whether or not he might have a bee sting allergy. I think that's TBD, so let's not praise Jesus just yet. But, you know, I guess a little bit of praise is in order, that it was not a rattlesnake bite.
Yeah, it would have been like pretty rare, but like not impossible here where I live, a rattlesnake. So I like scoured the yard afterwards to find a rattlesnake, but turns out just a bee. So, but man, it being just a bee and not like a rattlesnake or like a scorpion or a black widow, this Gonzo, he is quite the drama queen. And I'm going to make fun of him for the rest of his life.
Don't let him live this one down.
Yeah, because he's over here crying. He was limping. He was shaking. Like, what a weirdo.
And this is not even like an Africanized killer bee, right? We're talking garden variety bee.
Just a bumblebee.
By the way, there was something racist about calling them Africanized, right? Seems weird. Yeah.
Very problematic, those bees.
Speaking of problematic, this past week, I went to the cinema house and I saw our good friend Thomas Cruise in Mission Impossible Part 7.
Oh, how did you enjoy it? And were you alone in the theater, apparently?
Well, let's not go, you know, spreading rumors about the demise of the film industry via the poor box office. There were people. I mean, I'm not like fully full, but I don't think movies are fully full anymore. I think those days are over.
That's probably true. Unless you're Mario. Mario did well. Wasn't there another one this year that did pretty well?
Spider-Man, right?
Spider-Man did well. So, yeah, it's happening, but not pretty much everything has bombed. Fast X, I don't think, did well, and that's like usually a shoe-in to do well. Yeah, it's been wild.
Well, I thought they did well in terms of delivering me the thrills that I was craving. I had a great time at the box office. In the theater. The box office itself was typical exchange of cash for tickets. It was fun. I had fun. I mean, I think it's probably my favorite Mission Impossible movie. This is a series of movies that I like. I feel like they don't really make these kinds of fun action movies for adults anymore. And by for adults, I mean, it's not about superheroes. It is kind of, I guess, a little bit brain dead because most of these movies have the exact same plot. And this one's really no exception, but still fun. Dudes are launching themselves off cliffs. What more can I ask for?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like not hyped about it, but I might go see it. I like a lot of the cast. I like that Rebecca Ferguson lady who's in it.
Yeah.
And Mantis from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, I guess I like Tom Cruise, but so I might go see it. There's nothing else out right now.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a few days of dead time before Barbie and Oppenheimer take over the world.
Yeah.
You might as well go see this first.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a couple of days.
Probably will be no screens left for this film once those two guys open up.
True. And there's that big horror movie, that new A20. I think it's A24. There's like a big ghostly horror movie coming out that people are hyped about.
Oh, that sounds on topic for this podcast, but I know nothing about it.
Yeah. I don't know. People say it's scary. I don't know. I guess there was like a sneak preview, so people are going nuts for it. But I guess there's going to be a lot of stuff in the theater if we just wait a few more days.
Yeah. What about your past few days, though? You get up to any antics other than saving the life of Gonzo?
No, just saved Gonzo's life. The wife went with her mom to Vegas for the weekend, so I just had like a dude's weekend out with the three dogs. We just like hung around and like I shared my pepperonis with them, and like we lived like real bachelors. Like we stayed up late watching like dog shows and stuff together because they like watching that kind of stuff. Or at least Gonzo does. He watches TV. So,
what kind of dog shows we're talking about? Talking about that? What's that guy? The dog whispering guy? Is he involved?
Not that guy. I watched Gonzo's like some kind of weird mutant. And he knows dogs even if they're not real. So we watch Scooby-Doo together and he like gets real active and barks at Scooby-Doo when Scooby-Doo's on screen and stuff. So, just stuff like that.
It's cool. Yeah. Sounds like a pleasant weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun. Nothing too crazy happened. Just guys being dudes, you know?
Oh, no. Just guys being dudes?
Exactly.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Well, speaking of guys being dudes, should we talk about one of our dudes, one of my dudes, I guess, in our first segment?
I would love to, because, yeah, I didn't really know that this was one of your guys. This guy we're going to talk about. I know that you're into guys like this, but not this specific guy. So I'm curious about why you picked this for a topic.
Well, he's kind of becoming one of my guys. Yeah. So I'll just say it right now. The topic that we're doing on this first segment, sorry to disappoint everybody. It has no thematic connection to the film that we're reviewing. we're not going to be talking about thievery up top here. We're not even going to be talking about, neon lights necessarily, but we will be talking about a man on the same episode that we talk about a Michael Mann movie, so maybe that's something
that counts.
And the man is Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, who is not fully one of my guys yet. I think if we're talking about silent films, probably my number one guy still is Harold Lloyd. I'm also a big Snub Pollard fan. And, you know, there's a few other guys from the time period that I enjoy. But I didn't know much about Fatty Arbuckle at all until, I don't know, a few months ago, the Criterion Channel put up a bunch of his short films. And I ended up watching, I don't know, about a dozen of them. And I thought, hey, this guy is pretty funny. And, you know, I feel like we all, you know, even these days, we all love a funny fatso, you know, be it a Chris Farley or a John Halloween Candy. So, mm-hmm. You know, I figured why not peep at the granddaddy of them all, Fatty Arbuckle. Probably not actually the first famous funny fatso, but maybe the first to parlay it into worldwide superstardom. I'm not sure if maybe Billy Shakespeare cast a Dom DeLuise type back in the day who was locally renowned for his, you know, round theatrics. But in terms of like worldwide superstar, Fatty really was that. People loved him. These short films sold across the planet in huge numbers. And this week we'll be talking about and actually doing a quick little commentary on top of Coney Island, also known as Fatty at Coney Island. This is a 1917 two-reel silent comedy film that stars, written, and was directed by Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, also co-stars Buster Keaton. So there is a copy of this, or many copies of this, for free on YouTube. We'll be watching the one uploaded by an uploader named Silver Screen Filmotech. But if you just search Coney Island 1917, you'll probably find a copy. The version that we're watching is about 25 minutes, 56 seconds. And if you're ready, I think we can pretty much just get it rolling. We'll do the countdown. Okay.
Okay. I got it queued up.
So we'll count down. This is not it yet, but just to tell you what I'll be doing 3, 2, 1, and then I'll say 3, 2, 1, and then go, and we'll be clicking on the go. How about that?
Perfect.
Okay. So starting now, 3, 2, 1, go. So here we have it. Fatty Arbuckle in Coney Island. This is a Paramount picture from 1917. And they did shoot this at Luna Park, Coney Island, which you can see here at night in 1917, which I think makes this one of the cooler silent films of the period, because, you know, a lot of them just filmed on kind of nondescript back lots in Los Angeles. But these guys went all the way back to New York to shoot this cool stuff at the theme park. And you get to see some of the cool theme park attractions of the day.
Yeah, not often that you have a movie this old that is shot anywhere other than a soundstage.
Yeah, and I've never been to Coney Island. I know it's still there, but probably not as cool as it was in 1917. We get to see this parade. People are rubbernecking. That looks like Buster Keaton from behind, right, I think?
Yeah, that's a Dalek from Doctor Who, I think.
Yeah, this is the Doctor Who parade, of course. Mm-hmm. Very popular at the time. I think these days most people know Fatty for his famous rape trial, which was a huge scandal at the time. I mean, you knew this, Bowman, right? You can't be surprised I'm bringing this up.
I was wondering how far we got into this before we both had to disavow his personal life.
Well, so that is the thing. I think today people still have an image of Fatty Arbuckle as being this terrible rapist man. But history doesn't seem to bear that out as true. I was recently watching that 1980 Hollywood documentary, and they dedicated nearly a full hour-long episode to Fatty Arbuckle and the trial. And if the documentary is to be believed, it seems like he was totally innocent. You know, he was never convicted. There was a lot of shady stuff going on with the trial. But I did think one thing that was interesting that they mentioned in that doc was, even after he was exonerated and they did not convict him for any crimes, William Hays, the guy who created the Hays Code, still banned Fatty Arbuckle's movies from public showing from 1922 onwards until the end of the Hays Code. So that almost killed the dude. I mean, it did kill his career and almost killed our ability to even see these movies. They could have been lost forever. But an interesting guy who, sadly, yeah, his life was destroyed by scandal that seems like was just a lot of baloney. But here he is. Speaking of baloney, here's the fat man himself playing on the beach with a dog. I think you can relate to these kind of dog antics, right?
Indeed so. Now, this man who's named Fatty, he looks like just a slightly more fat than average guy in 2023.
Yeah, that's fair. And considering that the female co-star with him here on the beach is about his size as well. He doesn't seem strikingly fat, but maybe later in the film when he disrobes a little bit, we might be treated to a better glimpse of his fatness. Guy was fat. I mean, he was on studio prescribed morphine, I think at this time in 1917, due to pain from his fatness. You know, he was so fat. He had all this pain.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the time, a pretty extraordinarily fat guy, but not fat by today's standards necessarily.
I guess a little bit fat by today's standards. When you're dealing with a Great Depression, probably most people are skin and bones. The fact that this guy could even eat enough to fill out a suit is impressive.
True.
So, yeah, they're hanging around on the beach. People are wearing their best beach costumes. You know, very few long butts on this beach in 1917. Instead, this is back when you would swim in a full three-piece suit with a tie.
Yeah, those were the days.
Okay. Oh, she's lost her husband. Okay, we're getting some plot is being introduced here.
Fatty Arbuckle weighed somewhere between 250 and 300 pounds. So that is actually a little bit, definitely fatter than the average person, even in 2023. But
it's not doctor recommended.
Yeah, he might be
at that weight.
Yeah, this might be early in his fat career, maybe. Because he doesn't look too far gone so far.
So he's trying to get into this park, trying to get into Luna Park. Mm-hmm.
Which is, of course, a reference to the Bret Easton Ellis novel Lunar Park, which came out in 2005.
It seems like it must be.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Buster Keaton already famous at this point? Or was he? Is he like playing
Not
second
quite.
Banana?
Yeah, okay. He's kind of second banana. He came up with Fatty. That's where he really started his career. And then not too long after this, he would break out and start doing his own. I think largely because of the scandal, you know, he had to get away and start his own career. Otherwise, he might have been with Fatty for longer.
Oh, yeah.
So, but yeah, there are fewer, like, there aren't any real crazy Buster Keaton kind of stunts in this one. This is more of just kind of a silly little trifle of a silent.
So to go back to Fatty Arbuckle's possible crimes.
Yeah.
Was he just accused of being like a normal rapist, or was it like, it was kids, right?
No, it was, I think she was an adult woman, but it was an actress, kind of a failed actress who, you know, was potentially raped and did later die of like a bladder infection or something. And so it seemed horrific, but all of the links putting Fatty like at the scene of the crime were extremely tenuous at best. And like the people making the accusations were known to have made false accusations in the past that were proven. And there was some kind of like, seemed like there was some bribery going on. The documentary goes into great detail on it, but yeah, he ultimately was found innocent of all charges. So yeah. Anyways, nobody's... Well, go ahead.
Well, what is happening right now? Is that like a waterbed racetrack?
Yeah,
what the fuck is going on?
This is the witching waves, and nobody's thinking about bad times when they're on the witching waves. This looks like a great time.
This is the most incredible thing I've ever seen. Like, is it water underneath there? I would assume. This can't be safe.
Yeah, I mean, so it looks like we've got these little bumper cars that are on top of maybe a plastic sheet or something that is floating on top of these waves. And so you drive these bumper cars around, and it seems like you could maybe catch air.
Yeah, and they're riding around, like the motor, the little go-karts they're riding around on are made out of wicker, it looks like. This is astounding. Why does this technology not exist anymore?
Probably there's because, a lot of that going on. I mean, well, probably it was horrendously unsafe is my guess. And
yeah.
Maybe a pain in the ass to maintain, and could be a million reasons. But you do watch this, and it's like, man, this Coney Island used to look fucking cool. Like, look at all this production design that they got for free just by shooting here.
Yeah. Now it's just full of like Russian mafia dudes.
Yeah. And like liquor stores and stuff. But yeah. Back in the day, man, yeah. You got this pretty looking lake behind you and all these well-appointed men and their families going out for a nice weekend stroll.
Babies eating ice cream, just sitting up like little humans.
Everybody's having fun. Buster Keaton's there testing his strength.
Anyway, was that? Wait. Oh, okay. Oh, for some reason, a second ago, I thought that the guy with the ice cream was Buster Keaton. So I was like, how is there two Buster Keatons? That's the most amazing effect I've ever seen.
No,
but yeah.
This is back when people only had like four different faces, you know? But this guy's making the most of his face, making all kinds of expressions.
Yeah.
People are falling over. We got all kinds of physical comedy gags.
Yeah. This looks like a Chris Benoit match with all these front drop kicks into tables.
I think the thing that I like about Fatty Arbuckle, you know, that I've seen so far, there is like a sense of like enthusiasm. Like it seems like he's having a lot of fun making these movies.
Could be.
I mean, maybe he's just thinking about these terrible crimes he's going to go commit.
isn't that also the fat guy from Laurel and Hardy? Didn't he also wear this type of hat? Was it like mandatory for a fat guy to wear this sort of round hat?
I think so. Yeah. I think it was the law back then, you know, the shape of the hat must match the shape of your stomach. was, I think, the ruling. So if you've got a rotund belly, get in one of these rotund hats. So yeah, this is just a lot of kind of horseplay so far, it seems like. Although I'm enjoying these scenic views of the park. We got this cool log flume ride.
Yeah, that looks pretty intense.
I'd ride that.
It says, there's a sign that says, gentlemen, kindly sit on the left side of the boat. I wonder why gentlemen would have to sit on the left side. That's a really cool camera shot that they got it while going down the actual thing, it looked like. Or maybe not. I guess it could have.
I think it was real.
Yeah.
There's another movie. Oh, yeah. There's Fatty's Butt. There's another movie. I guess it's about 10 years after this. It is a sound picture from a guy named Eddie Cantor, who was another comedian around this time, that I just watched a couple days ago, wherein like the final 15 minutes is no joke. I think maybe the best roller coaster action scene I've seen in a movie. And it's from like 1929 or something. So they were qualified to make movies about amusement parks back then somehow. It's one of their first things that they figured out.
Yeah, seems like. I like that he slapped the shit out of that fish.
Yeah. Oh, poor Fatty. He's so fat he can barely swim. And he pulled Buster Keaton right into the water with him.
Mm-hmm. There's a book that I've been meaning to read by Jerry Stahl, you know, the Permanent Midnight fellow.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote this book about Fatty Arbuckle, but I think it's like a fictionalized account of his life. It's like sort of based on truth and sort of just like a novel, I think, is the premise of it. But it's like the only book of his I haven't read. And like some of his, I think he's got a couple of new ones I haven't read, but I've been wanting to read it for a while.
Sounds cool. So it looks like they've gone in now to rent a bathing suit. You could rent a bathing suit for a quarter back then. Seems like a fair price.
Yeah. Put it right on your junk and then turn it in. Let some other guy put his junk on it.
I don't want to oversell things, but this will lead now to one of my favorite sequences in the short. You'll know it when you see it. But Fatty's about to get up to some shit.
Surprised that they found a fat lady as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so Fatty has stolen the clothing, the bathing costume from this old woman because he's too fat. They don't have anything for him.
Well, that's a great joke.
That's a funny joke. That's the Statue of Liberty's husband, Fatty says.
Because of the tall guy. Man.
Yeah. So here we go. Fatty Arbuckle getting nude. Are we going to get to see him drop trow? Can we see it? Oh, he doesn't want us to see it. He's asking the cameraman to pan upwards in a breaking the fourth wall moment.
Very meta joke.
It's pretty advanced comedy for 1917.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping that we would actually just see that dick.
Well, if you want that, you're going to have to die of a bladder infection, unfortunately.
Yeah. That would have been very advanced comedy.
Seems like Buster Keaton's going to be applying for the lifeguard job here at the Luna Park swimming hole. And what has he stumbled upon? But Fatty Arbuckle in ladies' clothing? Is this a cross-dressing comedy from 1917?
Very ahead of its time.
That's my favorite part, is just seeing Fatty dressed up like a lady.
And then watching him kick the shit out of Buster Keaton in extremely violent fashion.
That's how Buster liked it. That's his fuck style.
Yeah. I like all these fake mustaches.
Yeah, I think that cop in the back with the fake mustache might have been Buster again. Or it could, again, just be that there's only four faces.
Yeah. They couldn't afford a lot of faces back in these days. It was Great Depression times.
Big role for an African-American performer in the background of that scene, sitting silently in a jail cell.
Yeah.
It's groundbreaking for them at the time, sadly.
These are the absolute worst dressing rooms I've ever seen. They look like jail cells. Like, it's just horrible to look at.
And minimal privacy. Men and women just kind of reaching from one changing room to the other. But Fatty's got his wig. He's looking great. He loves his look.
I know a lot of like nowadays we'll talk about like, oh, young kids could never understand this movie. Where like people talk on a telephone or like, you know, this movie about record players or whatever like that, you know, but like, this is hard to understand. The idea that a guy has to rent a bathing suit and then like he's so fat that like he has to dress like a woman. Like it's like, just take off your shirt and go to the fucking beach. You know, like this seems like a whole nother fucking planet. Like the rules that these people had back in the day.
Yeah, but also it could just be that maybe he knew that they wouldn't have his size and maybe he was just looking for an elaborate ruse that would get him into a lady's swimming costume. I mean, who's not to say that's not Fatty's preference to begin with?
Well, that could be. That could be.
And now a very risque scene with Fatty in the women's changing room. Now they are all fully clothed, but by 1917's definition, this is not fully clothed, I would surmise. I'm seeing some ankles.
Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah, this is before the code, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's why Fatty Arbuckle's getting so horny. It's on ankle.
It's a fun shot of Fatty Sands wig in the mirror.
Yeah. Just getting visibly horny.
It's going to cover up that boner.
Yeah. It's unsettling how much he's looking into the camera.
Yeah. Well, they didn't know back then.
Yeah. I don't know if it was like before they realized that people shouldn't do that or if like this was just like kind of his thing or what, but I do not like it. And like the film, like the sepia tone makes his eyes look very, very unsettling to me.
Yeah. There's like a weird glow to eyes that are filmed around this time.
Yeah.
Don't you think that cop that's asleep is Buster Keaton?
Let's see. Where is he at?
If we get him again. He was sitting down sleeping. And this broad looks a little bit like Elsa Lancaster from Bride of Frankenstein. It's not, but maybe they're related. I don't know.
In her locket with the picture of Fatty Arbuckle, did she have a picture of him fat and a picture of him skinny?
I don't know.
What was happening there?
I think there was a picture of James and Laura Palmer in there. I feel like these kind of antics, though, these cross-dressing fat man antics, they are evergreen, right? I'm sure we could find a similar scene in every famous funny fat man's filmography, you know, whether it be a Farley or a Candy. They're all putting on dresses. We love to see it.
Tyler Perry's made an entire career out of it.
There you go. But Fatty was there first.
Yeah. He's carrying the torch for big fellows dressing like ladies.
We got Buster Keaton back in the mix doing backflips out of nowhere. Love that.
Yeah, just
he's got to show off. Like, hey, I do have physical stunt skills. I'm not going to get to use them this week, but don't forget, I can do stuff like this. Mm-hmm. Now, do you think if you were dressed up in a old-timey ladies bathing costume, you would bring along a little parasol umbrella? Would that be part of your ensemble?
Yeah, I mean, on a hot day, you have to.
I like how it works for him.
Yeah, people carry around those umbrellas here pretty regularly just to so they don't die from the sun. I don't know if people have to do that down there. Probably not. But up here, it's pretty regular. If you see somebody walking around on the street, I would say about 35% of the time they've got an umbrella with them.
Really? That's a high number. Down here, it's only like maybe, you know, once in a while you get the weird eccentric old lady doing it.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a little high. I would 20% for sure. 20% is more realistic. But yeah, it's pretty regular during the summer months that people have umbrellas. It's very old timey.
Who's that fat lady?
What a rude lady.
But that's how convincing he was. This is top level drag performance. I mean, he's fooling actual ladies there in 1917.
This seems problematic. Between Fatty Arbuckle's private life and now all of this regressive gender bending talk. I feel like we're going to get canceled for watching this.
Everybody's having fun with this. Come on.
Now this guy is turning in. He's a rapist now. This guy trying to kiss Fatty Arbuckle.
Were you surprised, though, to see cross-dressing be such a central plot element in a movie from 1917?
It was like, that was like a real vaudeville thing, I think, though. It's like,
yeah,
dudes but dressing I feel up like ladies.
Post-code, you know, once William Hayes gets to banning stuff, I think cross-dressing was high up on his list of stuff he wanted to ban right away.
Yeah, that's probably... I mean, yeah, I guess that seems accurate because it didn't really come back until the Benny Hill days or something when it was seems like maybe that was when it came back as a humorous art form.
I feel like it wasn't even until John Waters in terms of U.S. movies having much cross-dressing in them, but.
That could be, I don't know what year Benny Hill existed. It could have been the 40s. It could have been the late 80s. I'm not too sure.
Also, I think they got a whole other set of rules over there in England.
That's true.
You see those fancy clothes the boys put on over there. I mean, they're already kind of halfway dressed to lady type.
Yeah. Then, they're so far behind us that, their comedy in, the 60s is probably akin to what our comedy was in 1917.
Yeah. Well, they're still making Silence over there pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Just starting Silence to produce three reelers over there.
Silence is what happens when I watch a British comedy. Sit very quietly the whole time.
We got our cops again. One of them might be Buster. I think the guy who just fell on the left, I think that was Buster, maybe.
Could be. They got really big fake mustaches.
It's hard to tell behind a mustache that big. I think the mustaches are getting bigger throughout the short. And if so, that's kind of a funny joke.
Yeah.
And if not, it's just the pixels aren't perfect.
Buster Keaton, he's kissing a girl in public? That seems like it probably should have been illegal at the time.
Yeah, I think he actually did serve time for that. He was convicted.
Kissing ladies?
Yeah, kissing in public. Not really, no.
Wait a minute. Who wants Fatty Arbuckle in the same cell? Who's talking here? Oh, because they want to fight? Is that why they want to be in the same?
Yeah.
Okay.
He wants to throw down.
I thought it was going to get even more problematic for a minute.
Oh, you thought that they were going to be making love in that cell?
I thought that's what the joke was for a second. But they just want to be in the same cell so they can fight.
They can duke it out all old-timey comedy style, where they both face camera while they fight each other.
It's kind of the opposite of what happens, on WWE, where dudes are backstage watching WWE and they have to stand all weird at an angle, you know?
Yeah.
So that you can see them, but they're also watching TV.
Well, we got some fatty on cop violence. I love seeing this.
You strip that guy down.
See these cops get their comeuppance. Yeah, that's got to be Buster in that mustache.
This is weird. This is too weird of old timey stuff.
Well, this is how they made him.
Yeah. I like that it would have been funny to just beat up cops in 1917. I feel like now if you release this in a cross-dressing guy beat up a bunch of cops, you'd have a bunch of dudes being like, oh, this is woke Hollywood bullshit. You can't release this.
That's what I'm saying. This is, I think it's kind of progressive. That was the thing that surprised me when I saw this was oh yeah, cool Coney Island footage. But then you get towards the end and you're like, this guy's cross-dressing. He's beating up cops left and right. Mm-hmm. This is not my image. He's body positive. He's got good dance moves. It's kind of a dance picture now because he did that little soft shoe right there.
Yeah.
And then the conclusion is that they resolve that women were the cause of all their troubles. And from now on, they'll cut them out and stand for men only. So this is a real men's rights origin story, I guess.
Yeah. Kind of the origin of boomer humor. Take my wife, please.
don't read about the original ending of this that was cut afterwards. Oh, please don't read about it because it's a little bit upsetting. And
Tell me the original.
Okay, see this woman walking there?
Yeah.
And he goes up to her and he's going to tap her on the shoulder. And then we just cut it and we fade out. And we don't know what happened. And I think that's for the best.
What happened?
You don't want to know.
Tell me what happened.
Well, she turns out to be an African-American woman and he's horrified by the prospect and runs away.
Is that real?
It is real. But
those
were the attitudes at the time. Yeah, they filmed it. It was distributed that way for about a decade. And then people, you know.
Is it on YouTube? Can I see this?
I don't think so. I've never seen it with that ending, but Wikipedia talks about it.
Oh, my God.
But oh, I mean, that was par for the course back then.
That's
terrible. You made some terrible racial jokes, and yeah, you made a men's rights activism promotional film. Yeah, you got convicted for rape and murder. Yeah, it's 1917.
Oh, here it is. All right, he's talking to her. She turns around. She's a black lady.
Oh, you found it.
Yeah, he makes a funny face like he's going to faint, and then he runs away because she's... Oh, my goodness. This is the guy you're trying to watch. Well, I can't believe this, Sean.
I'm not saying he's a perfect individual, but I think it's interesting that these movies are available now. They give us a little bit of insight into a vastly different time where people had bad attitudes towards a lot of things, but also they had the witching waves, which was a cool-looking fucking ride. But I still don't know how they did it. So.
Yeah. Well, that original ending's on YouTube. Just search for Coney Island 1917 original ending and you can see it.
Please don't. But let's maintain this wholesome image of Fatty Arbuckle that we all have, that we've all always had.
Well,
let's not taint his legacy.
So, yeah, I suppose this original ending is the least of his troubles.
Yeah. Anywho, I mean, yeah, maybe not the most thrilling 20 minutes, 25 minutes of your life, but hopefully it was fun enough to talk over and saves you the hassle of having to go to Criterion Channel and watch any of these by yourself.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point, but yeah. Let's check in on some of these fellows out there in junk food dinner land and see fellows and ladies, actually, to see what they've got to say about the things they've been watching and how problematic and other problematic people, I think. Let's see. Let's play this one first. Let's go with this one, since this one talks about somebody who's problematic.
Please welcome Leah Sweet, man.
You're so sweet. You're so sweet.
So, like, there's this big controversy going on with them Jonah Hill's guy, you know, Fanny Bryce is from, a chubby Fanny Bryce from the Broadway.
What?
That fired brother. Well, I guess he's been using, like, this therapy jargon he was with his ex-girlfriend who was this cool surfy lady, like the Kool-Aid man, when the Kool-Aid man surfs, like if you ever seen that, that's what she does, but she's not a big picture of Kool-Aid, she's a human being. Well, apparently his therapist is this guy named Scott, right, you know, and it occurred to me that well, there's that car, the Stuck Bearcat, that was named in the song Sweet Jane by the Velvet Underground. And I'm pretty sure that Jonah Hill's been talking to a sentient car, and that's why he's getting all this kind of crappy advice. And I think a lot of Hollywood celebrities have been talking to this sentient My Mother's a Car-esque car. You know, so that's probably why we're not in a very good state in terms of cinema right now, or at least in the Hollywood, you know. Also, did you know that Jerry Van Dyke's daughter did porn? That's pretty neat, though. But yeah, I'm pretty sure for that Netflix documentary that he made about the talking car, he just hired some old hobo and told him to pretend to be the talking car, or maybe they had the talking car ADR over him. That's just my guess. Like, I'm not 100% certain, but I'm like 95% certain.
All right. Well, thank you, Mia. I think this Jonah Hill controversy is wild. It's been wild to follow. But at the same time, I also feel like it's weird that people care one way or the other about Jonah Hill. Like, he's like he's such an innocuous man. Maybe that's not even the right word, but it's like he doesn't even seem like a real person. I don't know. It seems weird to devote all this internet controversy to him, but I don't know. What do you think about this voicemail, Sean?
Well, I think it's kind of incredible that Mia brought up a fat actress from the silent film era right after we just spent 30 minutes talking about one of the great fat actresses from the silent film era, Fanny Arbuckle. So cool that Fanny Bryce came up, I guess. I actually don't know much about the Jonah Hill controversy. What's the deal? He was a bad boyfriend or something? Is that what we're angry about?
That's pretty much the gist of it, is he was a bad boyfriend.
Well, I wasn't going to date him anyways.
Yeah, he met this lady online who's like a surfing instructor / influencer, and they started dating. And then he sent her a bunch of emails about how it hurts his feelings when she posts pictures of herself in a bathing suit on Instagram, which like is her job. So it's like kind of like a real douche move. But at the same time, it's like we live in a world where like, you know, with Fatty Arbuckle. So it's like that seems like pretty low on like the list of people to like be offended by is like this Jonah Hill thing, I feel like. But
well, you didn't see the original ending to Moneyball. You should have seen what he said to Reggie Jackson.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe I'm being regressive or something. I don't know. But it does seem like a douchey move.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really care about people's sex lives unless they're, you know, sending text messages about wanting to indulge in cannibalistic fantasies. Then, I mean, that's probably at the level which it rises to my slight interest. But even then, I'm like, I don't want to know these things.
I will definitely, if it makes me regressive to say that Armie Hammer did not deserve to lose his career for being into cannibal play, and that's fine, because I feel like that guy did nothing wrong. He's just into some weird sex stuff, and he should be exonerated.
You're pro cannibal play.
Well, I mean, as long as you're not actually doing any real cannibalism, or at least non-consensual cannibalism. I mean, if it's just something you're into, go for it. Have fun.
Kind of a weird fetish.
With that being said, I don't know the details. Maybe he was like making it non-consensual. I don't know. I'd have to look into it before I fully commit to defending him. But if it's just a fantasy you have, which I think was the extent of it, I don't know. I might be wrong. But like, that doesn't seem like an offense to lose your career over being a pervert.
Yeah, not when you're that handsome.
Yeah, you ain't lying. That's a good-looking man.
Yeah. Well, any other voicemails out there in junk food dinnerland or junk food supperland?
Indeed so. Speaking of good-looking men, I assume. I don't know who this one's from, but maybe that segue will work.
Baba
hey,
boom.
Guys. Satan here again. We are so close to episode 666. I can taste it. Tastes like chicken. Seriously, though, what's up with this heat? It's hotter than hell outside. And I mean that literally, because we just had air conditioning installed. It's a comfortable 70 degrees here in the underworld. What are you guys doing to beat the heat? I've been eating virgin blood snow cones, and I turned the lake of fire into a wave pool. That's fun, but my inner tube keeps melting. Excuse me, what's that, Jeffrey? Oh, okay. All right, I'll tell him. Epstein is here. He wants to say hi. He's a real big fan of the show, especially all the movies with sex crimes that Kevin has picked out over the years. In fact, we're all fans here, and we really can't wait to see which truly evil films you picked out for next month. Too bad you already did Oogie Loves.
Well, thank you, Satan. We are doing some evil movies. At least two out of three. Yeah, at least two out of three. I know we're doing Invitation to Hell, the Wes Craven movie, and then some other things that I didn't pick, so I don't remember them.
Yeah. Indeed we are.
This is going to be very evil. I thought about doing a Roman Polanski movie. Speaking of Fatty Arbuckle and around.
Oh, jeez, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of off-screen terrors.
Yeah. But, yeah, I was afraid that if I did a Roman Polanski movie, then, like, Quentin Tarantino would show up on our podcast and start talking about Rick Dalton like he's a real guy. And I was like, I can't have that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want that to happen.
Hey, speaking of eating things to beat the heat, I was recently at a shopping mall that had a Dippin' Dots store. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got to pop into that Dippin' Dots store and see what flavors are on mix. They had this cotton candy Dippin' Dot that I never tried before. Delicious. And man, those things are cold.
Yeah, I've only had Dippin' Dots one time at Kings Island. Because when I was a young man, that was like basically the only place you could get them. And now they're a little bit more common. But yeah, I still haven't had them any more than that. But I remember them being really, really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, they're a fun time. It will potentially give you like a full body brain freeze scenario. If you're not careful and you eat them too quickly, you're going to have a bad time. But, you know, as long as you like pizza and French fry while you eat them, like they're pretty fucking tasty.
Yeah, maybe I'll get some more. Sometimes they show up at like events here, like the Swedish festival and stuff like that. They'll have like a booth with them.
Yeah, it's the ice cream of the future.
Yeah. Speaking of the future, I guess in our future next segment, we'll be talking about the hit movie Thief.
Oh.
From 1981. So I think we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about that movie.
Christ in lice. Just diamonds of cash.
They got to be big scores. They got to be fast.
How big?
Box cut. Not the six figures.
We know you got something major coming down.
We are on.
James Gunn, Thief, rated R.
Starts Friday at select area theaters.
Welcome back to Junk Food Supper. The movie we'll be talking about this week is Thief. This is a 1981 movie. It is directed by Michael Mann, who did not direct To Live and Die in L.A. I made a mistake a couple of weeks ago. I deeply apologize.
Not just a mistake, but let's be honest, a real boneheaded goof.
Yeah, I was a boneheaded goof. But in my defense, if you look up the movie Thief on IMDb and you go down to the similar movies section, the first one is To Live and Die in L.A. So I still retain that if you like To Live and Die in L.A., you would like Thief probably. But I guess we'll find that out.
Are you sure that's really on IMDb and not on IMPB, the I Am Parker Bowman website that you maintain as an alternative to IMDb?
That is the one. It's my version still has the message boards. So if you ever want to, you know, call anybody a slur, just join my website.
I appreciate that kind of hustle, you know, picking up on all the typo visits. Pretty smart of you.
So this is a movie directed by Michael Mann. Like I said, he you know him as the guy who did Heat. He did Manhunter, The Keep, Collateral, Ali, lots of classics, and then also some blunders as well.
Wait, Mann's the Manhunter man?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Okay.
This is his second movie. It stars James Caan, who is a very cool guy.
Well, is his first movie just a TV movie, though?
It's The Jericho Mile. I don't know. Was that a TV movie?
I think it's a TV movie, yeah. So this is his first theatrical endeavor, I believe.
Okay, yeah. So this is his first real movie then.
Except for that Chinese theater that he owns, of course. Man's Chinese theater, yeah.
That's a terrible joke. And so in this, James Caan plays a guy named Frank, who he's a thief, as you might imagine. He's a bank robber at night, and then by day he owns a couple of businesses. He owns a bar, and he owns a used car lot in Chicago, which is cool. Not a lot of movies like this take place in Chicago, so it's a welcome sight.
I figured it would have been LA just based on the little that I knew of this movie, just some of the imagery and stuff. I just figured, oh yeah, it's going to be LA, just like every other movie. But no, yeah, Chicago.
Yeah, and I think Michael Mann's like kind of synonymous with LA. I think, like I know Collateral takes place there, and that's like a really, like they really utilize LA in that movie. And I think Heat might take place in LA
too. Oh yeah,
I'm not.
Yeah, Heat's okay. Very LA centric.
Okay, so yeah, and maybe part of Manhunter does too. It's been a while since I've seen that, but yeah, he's kind of an LA guy. So yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, it is.
He's a man about town down here.
Indeed, so.
Any way we can work in a man pun, it's gonna happen. That's my guarantee.
I appreciate that. So he's doing these diamond heists. He's a safecracker, but he kind of wants to get out of that. He's got his eye on this lady, Jessie, played by Tuesday Weld. He maybe wants to settle down with her, get out of the safe cracking lifestyle. He does a big score and he takes the diamonds to his normal guy, but it turns out that some other guy killed his guy. Like the guy takes his diamonds and he's like, all right, I'll take the diamonds and I'll give you the money at the normal spot and blah, blah, blah. But before he can do that, he's taken out by Robert Protsky, who plays Leo. This guy, you may know, he's in Mrs. Doubtfire. He's like the friendly theater guy from Last Action Hero. He's
Grandpa Fred from Gremlins 2.
Yep. So kind of playing kind of against type here, I guess. I don't know what his early career was like, but I mean, I think of him as like a nice old man. So it's weird that he's like kind of a heavy dude in this, but he does it well. And so that guy, it turns out that guy, who's involved in all of this, he reaches out to Frank and he's like, hey, Frank, I know we're off on the wrong foot here, cause our guys killed your guy, but do this, you know, let's do some jobs together. We can make a bunch of money. It'll be great. And at first, Frank's reluctant to do this cause he likes to work on his own. That's like his whole thing. He's like, his businesses are his own. He does the safe cracking on his own. He doesn't like to have to answer to anybody, which is a big thing in his personality. Anytime he has to answer to somebody, it's very anti-authority, very independent. But in order to get this idealized lifestyle, or idealized life that he wants, he kind of has to do it because Leo offers him like a big payday. So in order to settle down with this lady who is reluctant to settle down with him because he tells her what she does and she doesn't want to get involved with that. And also to get his friend, Okla out of jail. He's friends with Willie Nelson, who is kind of his mentor. He goes to visit him in jail and Okla tells him that he's dying and he doesn't want to die in jail. So he asks him for help to get out. So these two things, make Frank get involved with this mob and do this really big heist. And then after that, he's going to get out of the business and settle down. Or so he thinks. And I guess we can talk about the or so he thinks part as we go on. But that's basically the plot of this movie. I went through like a big Michael Mann phase where I watched a bunch of his movies a few years ago. And I watched this one and I liked it. I wasn't in love with it. Like I've heard people be like, yo, this is a fucking masterpiece. This is a banger. A lot of people whose opinions I respect. So I went into it kind of expecting a 5-star banger, but liked it a great deal. And now that I'm watching it again, it's like one of those movies that I think about a lot. I think about the prettiness. I think about this great character of Frank, who doesn't put up with anybody's shit and kind of really, really fights to kind of carve out a piece of the pie. There's like a lot of Americana stuff in here, a lot of blue collar, you know, small business owner stuff versus like the man. I think Leo kind of represents the man in a lot of ways. He represents like big business or whatever. And so there's a lot of that in this, which I like. I like rooting for the little guy. And so I've thought of, you know, it's a movie I think about a lot. So I like it a lot more watching it this time. There's a really cool scene at the beginning where Frank is in the office of the guy who has ripped him off early on. And there's like a train track, I guess it's like the L or whatever in Chicago, in the background. And like they I'm pretty sure they timed the scene. I think it's shot on location. I think they timed the scene so that right as like Frank's pulling a gun on him, like the train goes past the office, like you can see it out the window, like right by. And I think that's really cool. I mean, I guess it might have been like green screen or like rear projection or something, but I think it was real, right? What do you remember that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very striking moment because it's a very tense scene to begin with, but there's all this kind of traffic business going on outside the window right behind them. And then at the very end of the scene, like just as it's like building to a fever pitch, that truck comes through and it makes like a big kind of screeching, honking sort of a noise as it comes across the screen. And I had the same thought. I didn't know, was that planned? It seems like it could not have been a happy accident. Like it's too perfect. So they must have planned it somehow.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine, yeah, if you have the times for trains, you know, I mean, the times your trains are kind of known for running on time, I guess, like then you could conceivably start the scene at a certain point and then it would, you know, you would know that the train was coming at a certain time. So yeah, I definitely don't think it was an accident. So yeah. Yeah. Super cool scene. And I like a lot of other stuff. I guess we'll talk about it, but, you'd never seen this movie before. Are you a man's man? It sounds like you've seen Heat. Are you a man's man? And what are your initial thoughts on this kind of movie, Thief?
Well, I can't claim yet to be a man's man. I mean, I've seen Heat, which I did love, and I've seen Public Enemies, which I thought was fine, I guess. But I feel like I'm long overdue on seeing this one. This is a title that I've had on my watch list for a while, you know, much for the same reasons that you mentioned that, you know, a lot of people who have seen this had really good things to say about it. And it does seem like the kind of movie that I will love. So, you know, I was very intrigued by this. And, you know, I think the first thing that you...
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt, but I thought you would love it for that kind of climactic scene that happens at the used car lot with all the lights and the neon. I was like,
yeah.
That's the scene that made me pick this over picking Manhunter.
Yeah, those lights are some of my favorite lights in cinema history. Like, I think you're talking about the scene towards the end at the used car lot where, like, above the car lot, they hang all these little, like, globe lights on strings. And I think that is a real thing that a lot of car lots do. I don't think they invented it for this movie. But something about the way that Michael Mann shoots these light sources at night, it just looks great. Like, everything is... you know, naturally kind of dark, like nothing looks overlit or fake or false or like there's a big floodlight anywhere. Like it looks dark. It looks like nighttime, but then all these light sources just pop out like perfectly. It's really beautiful. And overall, yeah. I mean, that is what I like about this movie the most is, you know, how, I guess I would say handsomely photographed this thing is. Like it's just chock full of all these, you know, extremely masculine process shots of James Caan operating heavy machinery, you know, these big drill things that he's doing. And you get these close-ups of these drill bits boring through these big steel safes and stuff like this. It looks fucking awesome. And then you've got these rain-drenched nighttime cityscapes that kind of have like a proto Blade Runner vibe to them. you know, despite this not being set in the future. And the neon looks great. I mean, there's a lot of neon signs in this. Maybe my favorite neon sign is one for a business called the Green Mill, Green Mill Cocktail Lounge. I thought that sign was just really cool looking. There's even a shot in this of, it's just kind of like a close-up shot of a car hood as the car is driving down the street at night, and reflected in this black hood of the car are all these neon signs that he's driving by. And I fucking love that shot. I thought that was just so incredible. And like a lot of shots in this movie, reminds me a lot of like Nick Refn, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that this was probably a huge influence on Drive.
Yeah, absolutely. It must have been a massive influence. I mean, the whole tone is very Drive-esque. And then this movie also does a thing that I think is pretty common now, but might have been revolutionary at the time, which is it utilizes that kind of, that filmic look. I don't know if it's a filter or the type of film that they use or some kind of processing that they do in development, but the film looks like it's got this kind of blue-green sort of a tint to it that I think when most people try to do that today, it usually looks awful. But somehow Michael Mann made it look great in 1981. So I like that about the look of this. The counterpoint, though, go ahead.
Oh, sorry to interrupt real quick, but yeah, going back to like the lights and like the neon bouncing off the hood of the car and then at the used car lot, like it's also amazing because, I mean, I assume that they probably like waxed up those cars like for hours to get them as reflective as possible. And there's never a point where you see like a camera reflection or like the big Hollywood lights like bounce off of anything. Like it's like the care that went into like getting the lighting right and then also it not backfiring anywhere. Like, I mean, it must have been insane to like put the camera in just the right spot so that you couldn't see its reflection anyway.
Yeah, totally. And for a guy who is new to feature films, I mean, he had made a TV movie, but this is his first theatrical experience, again, outside of the Chinese theater. We know about that. You know, I think that's impressive that he's able to pull off this. It's a crazy balance of like, it is very cinematic, this movie, but it's also naturalistic in a way that I think is kind of an interesting combo. Mm-hmm. But one area in which that naturalism does not work, I would say, is the sound. Unfortunately, I don't think the sound mix is very good in this movie. The dialogue is very low. There are times during dialogue scenes where it seems like the actors were maybe improperly mic'd. And like there's a lot of like ruffling or like just kind of distortion in their voices. I'm guessing they had to like bump the levels way up or something like this. And on the music side of things for the sound mix, there's not enough. I mean, I really like this music from Tangerine Dream, but it's not enough music to fill an entire movie. And in fact, there are long stretches of this movie that are pretty much completely silent, which maybe I'm guessing is a choice for Michael Mann, but I'm over here thinking I'd like some mood music. I don't know. I think you could put some atmospheric tunes under some of these driving scenes and stuff like this, much like Nick Refn would do later with Drive, and it would be even more stylish.
There is a scene late in the film where Frank is like going through another person's house, like looking for them, and he's got a gun, and it's all silent. There's no music at all. I think that works spectacularly.
Yeah, I mean, there are isolated incidents in which, you know, it does kind of work well, but I could still use some more of these tunes for sure. And then,
you like the score, though, you're saying?
I do like it, yeah. It's just not enough, you know?
I like it, too. During my research, I found something that shocked me to my core.
Oh, that it was nominated for a Razzie?
Yeah, the score was nominated for a Razzie, and it was also nominated for something called the Stinker's Bad Movie Awards.
Well, Jesus so, Christ. If it was nominated for a Stinker's... That means something.
Yeah, so the score was nominated for the one Razzie, and then it was nominated for 6 Stinker Awards, one of which went to the score, and then the rest of which went to the quote-unquote bad acting in the movie. So go figure. Hmm. But also, it was nominated for the Palme d'Or Award at Cannes that year. So go figure again, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I've come to learn over the years that the Razzies don't mean a hill of beans in this world, Bowman.
I don't give a hobo's hat about your Razzie awards.
Exactly. But I will say, I mean, maybe I do agree with them a little bit on one front, which is, I don't want to say the acting is bad per se, and James Caan is an actor that I usually do like, but I'm not sure this is the role for him. He seems to be playing this character with some, like, real, I don't know, unusual affectations, you know, and it just didn't feel like the real James Caan to me. Like, it felt like a put on the entire time. And it's not just the Chicago accent, which is kind of distractingly fake sounding in a movie that is filled with real Chicagoans, to have this dude from New York, this guy from New York just trying and kind of failing to do a Chicago accent. It's not just that. Like, there's also these, like, I don't know, like, nervous tics and stuff, and, like, weird kind of, like, behavioral choices that he makes. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, do you feel like there is kind of a lot of bits of business with this character? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, a little. I mean, he's a very anxious guy. You know, he's got a lot of energy, you know? So I think that's probably what he was going for. He's got, like, a lot of...
Yeah, he's kind of twitchy.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I was not always buying it. And I don't know, like, in some scenes, like, there's that scene where he's seducing the female lead in the coffee shop. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there, like, just kind of baffled. Like, I couldn't figure out what it was about him that she would possibly be interested in this guy who seems so creepy and is, like, revealing kind of his shitty life situation to her, and she's still down to hang out with this guy. I thought it seemed kind of implausible. But on the other hand, I will concede that a shirtless James Caan is hairy in a way that kids today just won't understand. And I guess that's worth something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really like that scene in the coffee shop because, yeah, at first she's very reluctant, you know, when he's talking about he wants to settle down and get married. She's really reluctant because, A, he was just, like, a super piece of shit to her at the bar and made a real scene pulling her out of it. But, like, the thing that turns her around is he carries around this picture that's, like, a collage of everything he wants in life. You know, and it's a house, and a wife, and kids, and his friend Willie Nelson. And, like, all these things that he just wants out of life. And, like, that's kind of, I think, what, still reluctantly, though, but, like, I think that that's kind of what turns her to kind of being into it, is, like, he's a guy who knows what he wants. And then also it's, like, and, I mean, he's a guy who wants to, like, settle down, which is probably not common if you're as good looking as James Caan, you know? And so, I think, like, just the fact that this guy has, like, this life goal, I think maybe appeals to her.
Despite the fact that that life goal is scrawled out on the crummiest looking little collage of all time.
It's a bad collage.
Couldn't get a real art department to work on this or something for him. I'm guessing James Caan did that himself while he was waiting for shooting to start, you know?
It's very possible. Also, there's a picture of Willie Nelson on there, who's his mentor. And she goes, "Who's the old man?" And Willie Nelson was 48 years of age at the time. I feel just...
Is that true?
Yeah, he was 48 at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
And, wow. Yeah, and she was 38 at the time, the actress. So, it's pretty wild, those ages. But, yeah. An old man, 48. So, we got that to look forward to in a couple of years. Yeah, but everything with that picture I love, and then the resolution with it at the end. I just, the idea that he just hang, you know, because he's an ex-con, he was in jail for like 20 years. So the fact that he has this, you know, this visualization of what he wants in life, and it's also kind of like, I don't know if, like, this is specifically what he wants, or if it's like he just has this idea of a thing he thinks will bring him happiness, you know, like. I mean, it's like kind of more of like where the like American dream stuff comes in. It's like he wants a house and a wife and kids and, you know, like this suburban nuclear family, and big, you know, the man stops him from having it. So I don't know. I like all that kind of stuff.
But it also, at the same time, doesn't seem like he really does want that or is not willing to make the actual sacrifices required to have that. Because, like, when the movie starts, he has a, is it a wife, or he's got a woman in his life that is leaving him because she, you know, I think it's revealed that she doesn't know about the jewelry heists, but she thinks that because he's going out all the time that he's cheating on her, and he's not willing to give up the jewelry heist game in order to save this relationship. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, part of that is, like, as he talks about in the coffee shop, is like, he can't make ends meet just with his businesses, which is why he still does it, which, I mean, maybe is just him justifying it. But I think that by the end of the movie, we do see, you know, by the fact that he tells Tuesday Wield to take, you know, her and the kid to just take off. Here's a bunch of money and just take off. Like, yeah, I think, I mean, I, you know, when he could have maybe just gone with them instead of going after the guy and getting revenge, like, I think that we do learn that once faced with the idea of getting exactly what he wants in life, like, that he is kind of not for him. So he takes it back. Like, I think that that's kind of what we're seeing at the end, is like, it's the life of crime was always the life for him. He couldn't do the other life. And so, I think that's where he ends up. And I mean, he ends up being exactly what Willie Nelson is at the beginning of the movie. Like, I mean, I think, well, that's who he'll turn up as, you know, a guy who's an old broken down piece of meat who dies alone in jail, you know, just like his mentor.
Yeah. And you, I mean, it's, this is not entirely new territory. I feel like you could probably find a handful of Westerns that have similar premises of, like, the guy who just can't hang up, you know, the six shooter. I guess Wild Bunch kind of has that sort of a vibe, mm-hmm. but it does lend some interesting complexity to the character here, where it's like, at first you might have one image of this guy, but, you know, turns out he is a little bit more multifaceted maybe than you might expect.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it's like, there's a, yeah, I think there's a lot of really interesting character stuff in here, and it's, like, not big. A lot of it's, like, just kind of like character moments. Like, you know, he's very reluctant to get involved with Leo, but then, you know, once he gets, him and his wife get turned down to adopt a kid because she can't have kids, like, Leo knows about this, which is, like, scary that he just knows this guy's business and, like, they don't really comment on that. But then Leo's like, hey, do this job for me. Keep on working with me and I'll get you a kid. I know how to get a kid. You know, I'm connected. I can get you a kid.
Which, and that, like, that stuff is kind of creepy in a way, or chilling, or it made me feel emotions. Just this whole thing of, like, this guy is going to go buy a child.
Yeah, it's such a good scene because, yeah, it's scary. Because, like I said, at first, like, just the fact that Leo's keeping tabs on him is scary. The fact that he can just get a kid whenever he wants, like, he, you know, he says he knows women who have made, like, mistakes and, you know, want to sell their kids off. And, like, yeah, that's creepy and unsettling. And so, like, this guy's clearly a monster if this is stuff that he is just regularly on his to-do list, is buy and sell people on the black market. But the, you know, when he tells James Caan that he can get him a boy, like, the emotion that comes over James Caan, the idea that, you know, he's going to have this son that he's been wanting for all these years, like, and then he's just, like, instantly on Leo's side. He hugs him and, like, yeah, there's just, like, so many conflicting emotions in that scene. I think that scene's really beautiful too.
He is a little bit let down though later on in the scene when Grandpa Fred reveals that the boy he's going to be delivering will in fact be a black Chinese boy. Which it was a surprising line of dialogue in the scene before, when they're at the adoption agency or whatever, and he's talking about, he'll take anything. I'll take a black kid. I'll take a black Chinese kid. Or he's got all these, these crazy things he's saying. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah. They're telling him that they can't adopt. So he says, I'll take, you know, anybody that nobody else wants, including an 8-year-old black Chinese boy, which, so I think that he's acknowledging racism more than participating in it, but he does use a slur that is, like, not cool. So I'm not totally sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The word was actually not Chinese. Now that I think about it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he is good though. I like the Grandpa Fred guy, playing kind of against type as the mobster in this. And it's just fun to see a guy who looks kind of like Larry Bud Melman, like be this evil. I thought he was really good. And I was right last week as well when I made the claim that I would enjoy seeing Belushi in this.
I
thought he was fun. Even if he does hard tackle a girl on the sand at the beach in this movie, in a way that made me hope she had life insurance. That looked like a real ass tackle.
Yeah, he gives her like a chop block like he's Ric Flair.
It's pretty wild. I also like the fact that Belushi in this looks a lot like Johnny Ferraro from the UFC documentary that came out recently. So if you've seen that, I think you know what I'm talking about. And it was also fun to see the redheaded stranger in this, you know, even though I do feel like they kind of wasted Willie Nelson, like his, well, spoiler, I guess, for this movie that we've already spoiled a million ways, mm-hmm. but his death in this doesn't really register for me as that emotional. I don't think, not in the way that it probably should have landed. I just felt like we kind of barely established him as a character at that point when they already kill him off. And, you know, I'm thinking over here, could have at least let him cover some Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison tunes or something like this, you know, before we whack him. But he's out pretty quick.
Yeah. I mean, I like it like symbolically, like what it means, like, cause at that point, like Frank's making a lot of money and he uses that money to bribe the judges to let Willie Nelson out. And it's like, he's kind of getting what he wants. So the fact that it doesn't work out and Willie Nelson does die like right after getting out of prison, like, you know, so like, symbolically showing Frank that he can't get what he wants, even with, you know, all this money and everything, like, I think it's good. But yeah, the actual death scene and the emotion of the personalness of it, yeah, it doesn't really come across. It comes off better, actually, in the scene that he's in before where he tells Frank he's dying and asks him to get him out. Like, there's a lot more emotion in that scene, I think, than the actual death scene.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that there must have been some way to, you know, they could have maintained this. Like I know that they want to have some sense of, you know, like sad irony, you know, that he's, you know, his whole quest is kind of rudderless now that Willie's dead. You know, there's really no motivation for him to go on anymore. But maybe I push that a little bit further down the runtime, or I don't know. The way that it landed here was kind of underwhelming. But, you know, that said, I think that there definitely is something here to this movie, you know, especially for the time, 1981. I feel like this kind of blending of like very artful photography and that kind of matter of fact realism that we see in the dialogue when they're talking about, you know, casing these joints and stuff like this, almost kind of like an Altman-esque naturalism to the way that people talk in this, probably seemed kind of revolutionary at the time. And I think that this does have all of the building blocks for something that I would love more than this later on, you know, like this is the blueprint for Drive. You know, it just kind of misses the mark a little bit in a few key ways for me, you know, I guess mainly being, you know, the casting of James Caan, I think maybe not the right choice. So in the end, you know, I would be lying if I said this was my favorite movie, but I do think it's a very good watch and I would recommend it to my friends and our listeners. It does, though, at the same time, feel a little bit like this is a first-time director, still kind of learning some elements of his craft, you know, like for instance, the final shootout to me felt a little bit goofy at times rather than tense. And maybe that was just me, I'm not sure, but it seemed a little bit silly. But overall, yeah, I still really enjoyed this and glad that I saw it and wondering where I should go next with Michael Mann. I think maybe Last of the Mohicans is probably the one that I'm most interested to see next.
I've never seen that one. I think as a person who loves watching LA on screen, I think maybe Collateral might be for you.
Well, but Last of the Mohicans starts with the letters LA.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that might be the one then.
So, yeah.
and then Manhunter is an absolute banger. So you might enjoy that.
All right. Yeah.
But I could also I did want to mention
I could rewatch Heat as well.
Yeah, I need to see that.
You oh, you, like, haven't seen, you haven't seen the Heat. You got to see the Heat.
I know. I got to see that Heat.
It's not my pick for next week.
Okay. Well, before we get to your pick for next week, I also did want to mention that the big heist that takes place at the end of this movie, which I think is great because like it's one of those things where like they actually it's like hurt like Werner Herzogian, where like they actually do the thing, you know, like they have this huge safe and they actually break into it and you see every minute of that and exactly how it works, which I think is really cool. But the build up to that, where like they're on the rooftops and they're breaking in and they're worried about like this alarm going here and how to shut off this alarm there. I think that was a big influence for the opening scene from The Dark Knight, where the Joker breaks into the bank, like that big, huge IMAX scene.
Oh yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of that scene a lot. So I like this Thief movie, but we do have to decide what we're going to, oh wait, how many stars are you going to give this on Letterboxd though?
It's at least a solid 4-star watch.
All right. That's pretty good.
I could see this being 4.5 on a rewatch. I'm probably not going to go there until I rewatch it, but yeah, at least a solid 4.
Okay. I like that. My first time watching this, I gave it 3.5 and now I'm up to 4.5. So I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
But all right, I guess now we got to decide what's coming next week. And I pray to God that this is the shortest deliberation segment of any Junk Food Supper episode ever.
Why are you praying to God that?
I'm hoping you make the right decision here.
What, you're thinking I should pick Heat? Come on, Barbie, let's go party. Oh, boy, there was that. I'm a Barbie girl. What are your plans, actually, for this coming weekend? Are you watching Oppenheimer and Barbie? Or are you just only gonna watch Barbie if I picked it?
Well, I'm going to see it. Either way, I think me and the wife have been talking. I think we're going to go see Barbie and then walk a block away and go get some tacos and then walk right back to the theater and see Oppenheimer.
I love it. Did you pre-buy tickets or is that not really a big thing?
Nah, I don't think I'll have to do that here in town. Despite the fact that like I live in a town of 100,000 people and there's one movie theater with like 6 screens, I don't foresee it being a problem.
Well, I am very tempted to pick it for our official review, but I also feel like
Barbie, let's go party.
I feel like I could be a sneaky little fella over here and presume that if I don't pick it, that you might pick it as segment one, where we could just chat about it for 30 minutes at the top of the show anyways. So I think I am going to go in a different direction. You know, maybe I might pick another James Caan movie and turn the show into an official Caan film festival.
Ah, that's a good joke.
No, but I'm not actually going to do that. Come on, Barbie, let's go party. No, it's not going to be Barbie, but I think you will be. I don't want to say that you're going to be excited about this pick. I think you're going to be intrigued with this pick. I think you might also be a little bit alarmed at what this pick means for the future of the show, because I'm going to be kicking off a soon-to-be long-running and soon-to-be critically acclaimed podcasting series here on Junk Food Supper, a little series I'm calling Journey to the Center of Podcasting, because next week we'll be reviewing 1977's Viaja al Centro de la Tierra, a.k.a. Where Time Began, a.k.a. Journey to the Center of the Earth, from the director of Pieces.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah. And as I mentioned during our review of the very grandpa 1950s version of Journey to the Center of the Earth, they made about 13 of these movies. The same story, 13 different times. You know, various directors, various countries, various mediums, some of them being animated. But this was the next one, chronologically.
I see. So that's what you'll be picking instead of the Barbie movie.
And potentially, depending on how this goes, we might be on this journey for the next 13 weeks of my picks. Which is effectively, I think, a full year.
full year of this thing.
Well, I mean, don't judge it too harshly until you know how many of them might feature Gertrude the Goose.
Hmm, and not Barbie, you say?
Not Barbie.
What? But you can't do this to me.
You know how much I sacrifice?
I'm sorry.
This is heartbreaking.
I think you have to cancel your plans. Now you're not allowed to watch it. Call the wife. What? Tell her bad news.
Well, all right. Well, it's a good consolation prize because I, what's the name of the JP Simone? Is that the guy?
Yeah. 1977 and or 78's Where Time Began is probably the most common title for it. But it is A Journey to the Center of the Earth. Trust me in that.
Okay. Well, that guy, I don't think he's ever steered me wrong. I think I've seen like 4 or 5 of his movies and they're all like really, really super good. So, and I'm certain that it'll be better than The Last Journey to the Center of the Earth. So,
yeah, we'll have to see. Who knows how many old timey iguanas were murdered for this one?
Well, probably a lot. I'm going to, being a European filmmaker, probably a lot.
Yeah, but Spain is lousy with iguanas. He was doing them a service, you know?
That's probably true.
It's a whole country overrun with iguanas.
Okay. I like the idea.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes. In all honesty, will I really take this journey all the way up until the one starring Brendan Fraser? Probably not. But I might. Yeah. That's a threat that I'm putting out there. And at any time, it could come back. I might return to this journey.
Well, I respect Brendan Fraser, but I don't want to watch the sequel with The Rock. That's where I would be drawing the line. But Brendan Fraser, he's welcome on this show anytime.
All right. Well, fair enough. He might just join us.
Okay. All right. This is interesting. All right. That takes us. All right. All right. Being based on a Jules Verne book, I'm a big fan of like those Victorian era literature dudes whose books got turned into like wacky 40s and 50s adventure movies. So we might go down a wacky rabbit hole coming up soon.
Yeah. And who knows, maybe by the time we get towards the end of this series of movies, maybe Alan Moore will have created his own version of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think Journey to the Center of the Earth is explicitly mentioned in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. So
I would imagine it must be.
Yeah. Well, all right. That'll be an exciting one. That'll be next week. So tune in for that, everybody. In the meantime, you can leave us some voicemails that we will play on the show by calling 347-746-JUNK. That's 347-746-5865. Let us know how you feel about Barbie, Oppenheimer, which one you're seeing first. What's the best Michael Mann? I guarantee I'll be picking another Michael Mann movie at some point because Manhunter's a banger. And I actually do think you would like Collateral, so maybe even that one at some point. Probably not in 2 weeks, certainly, but at some point. So let us know about all that kind of stuff. Let us know what else you're up to. Let us know what your thoughts are. This is especially important. Let us know what your thoughts are in the JFD meetup. We're getting serious, trying to get serious about making decisions here. Where do you guys want to go? What city should we go to? It's probably a pretty foregone conclusion that it'll be in October. Let us know where you want to go. And I think
also,
that's about it. Find us in the Discord. Find us on Twitter or whatever. I don't know. This is Parker Forrest Sean saying thanks for having fun.
Very nice.